Welcome to the Image Doctors. It's March 16th, 2006. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks for being with us again today, all you Nikonians out there. Today's show is brought to you by the Nikonians Silver, Gold, and Platinum members. For just $25 a year, you can purchase a Silver membership at Nikonians, get a 15-megabyte web gallery, access our contests and workshops, come on the ANPAT, and in general, feel proud of yourself for sponsoring the Nikonians community in its effort to be the worldwide home.
You'll just be an overall good person.
A good person. You can, yes, gosh darn it, people will like you.
They will.
So support the community. Consider upgrading today to a Silver membership and or more, and we'll see you online in the forums. So we have an email question for this week, Rick.
Yep.
From one of our listeners, Mr. Sean Karsmeyer from California. Sean, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right.
Yep, we did our best on that.
And Sean wants to know about hyperfocal distance, how it works, what it is, and essentially how to do it in practice. We talk about hyperfocal distance a lot, hyperfocal shooting, but it's one of those things that maybe we better just describe it into practical terms.
Yeah, it is one of those mysterious topics for people just getting into photography. And where it's used a lot is landscape photography as well as some street shooting. It's pretty popular in that case too. And here's the idea. Let's start off a little bit with what depth of field is, because hyperfocal distances are kind of a special case of depth of field. And the idea with depth of field is that for a given focal length, aperture, and format size, as well as certain size print that you're going to be evaluating, you can figure out what's going to be acceptably sharp. Now, the key thing with depth of field is it's not like there's going to be this one zone, you know, let's say from 8 feet to 15 feet, within which everything is perfectly sharp, and once you get out of that, it's just completely unsharp. It's not one of those things. It all has to do with perceptions. And the idea is that if you're looking at a certain size print, and the standard is an 8x10 print viewed from a normal distance.
What's a normal distance for an 8x10 print, Rick?
It turns out it's about equal to the diagonal of the print. So
about a foot and a half away.
Yeah, foot away, something like that. So just a normal, comfortable viewing distance, that things in that zone will look acceptably sharp, and things outside of it will start to get blurry. But in reality, there isn't any kind of black and white dividing point. It's just a zone within which things look acceptably sharp. So you can go to depth of field calculation tools. There's some good ones online, including on our website. And we'll post that link in our podcast forum that we have, just so you can take a look at that if you want. If you're using a fixed focal length lens, then there are usually some marks on there that'll help you calculate depth of field. You can look at, let's say, F16. It'll be marked on there either with a little F16 mark, or it might be color-coded if it's one of the older Nikon lenses. And then you can set a far distance and a closer distance. What you do is, let's say that you're shooting at F16 and you would like to have everything from 10 feet distant to the closest possible point that you could have in focus. What you do is you set 10 feet against the F16 mark that's toward the left, and then if you look on the right-hand side, you'll be able to see what that closest distance is.
So this is reading off the distance focus scale
on the lens.
Ring. Yeah.
And everything in that zone will look acceptably sharp, you know, for an 8x10 print. And it works very easily. It's pretty simple once you try it a couple times. Now, the variation of that has to do with hyperfocal, it's just a special case, and that special case is the far limit is infinity. So if you were using a lens like that that had the depth of field marks on it, what you would do is just align your infinity mark, in this case with f/16, if that's the aperture that you cared about using. And then everything from infinity down to a point that, yeah, Jason just grabbed a 50mm lens, so we'll use that as an example.
My original first lens I ever had.
Yeah, and this is one of the really cool older manual focus Nikkors that have the color-coded depth of field marks, which I love. So what it shows is that if you have the far f/16 mark aligned with infinity, that everything will be in focus down to around 8.5 feet or so is what it shows on there, roughly. And don't worry about the precise amount. Conversely, if you were going to do it for f/4, then you would find that everything is in focus from infinity down to around 30 feet or so, just a little bit more than that. So that's what the marks show. And so if you were, you know, doing the f/16 example, you, by setting those marks, you end up with a hyperfocal distance, which is the distance that you're actually focused on, that just a little bit more than 15 feet.
Yeah, that's where the dot on the lens is. So, if you line up the infinity on the left.
Yeah, it looks like it's right around maybe 17 feet, something like that. And so that works great for landscapes because you typically do want things in the distance and sharp focus when doing landscape photography. Not always, but most of the time. And so with this, you can have everything down to 8 feet in focus, and it'll look great. And if this is with a 50mm lens, if it's a wide-angle lens, then you'll have greater depth of field at the same focus distance. And you can have, you know, situations where everything is in focus from infinity down to just a couple feet.
Those make for some cool shots.
The key thing with this is try not to make it too hard. If you have a lens that has the marks, just use them, and trying it a couple times, it'll just become intuitive right away. It's very simple. If you don't have a lens with depth of field marks, and most recent zooms fall in that category.
Shamefully so, but
yeah,
that's the
shamefully
case.
Shamefully so, but a lot of it has to do with the way that they're constructed, and it's just a little bit harder to do the depth of field marks. Then what you can do is use either a printed table, and you can get some nice hyperfocal distance cards that you can carry in your pocket. You could print out a little table that you make in Word or Excel or whatever and stick that in your pocket.
Ooh,
and then
can I come from the shameless promotion department?
Go ahead.
Nikonians.org?
You bet.
You can buy the Nikonians hyperfocal t-shirt.
That's right. And it's printed upside down,
so you can
read
it.
Read it on the front of your t-shirt.
Absolutely.
Pretty cool.
I have one. It works.
Okay.
And they come in digital and film because the hyperfocal distance will depend on your format.
And that's an important thing. If you're using a digital body, it is a little bit different. And the marks on lenses will be for film, for 35mm. So what you want to do if you're using digital and you're using those marks is, let's say, rather than using the marks for f/16, if you're shooting at f/16, use the marks for f/11. That will give you a little bit tighter tolerances, and it turns out that there's just about a one-stop difference going to the smaller format. So that's the handy-dandy tip. So if you're shooting at f/16, use the f/11 marks. If you're having to use a table that's for film, do the same thing. But if you're using a digital table, it'll make that correction for you anyway. So hopefully that helps. It is a very, very useful technique. I use it all the time when doing landscape stuff, and it's quite handy. All right, so thanks for the question, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. So as you know, we were down in Florida and at the PMA show in Orlando. And afterwards, Rick, you got to stick around for a couple extra days, I hear, and hang out with fellow Nikonian Steve Lieber and go to a couple of places on the Space Coast that were for wildlife, especially bird photography, right?
Yeah, and we had a great time. The two places that we went to were the St. Augustine Alligator Farm as well as the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge. Both of them were great for doing bird photography.
I've been to Merritt Island in the past, and it's one of my favorite spots.
Yep.
I'll just
and
say
of course,
that
Jason
for...
had recommended it as a place to go. Now, you hadn't been to the St. Augustine Alligator Farm before,
No,
right?
But it's on my list of
things.
Even more so now after hearing your report. So why don't you tell our listeners how
I'll
that
tell
went
you it
for
was
you.
Great. Steve and I got there fairly early in the morning. We drove up from the Titusville area, and Met John Bruggen, who's the director of the Alligator Farm, at about 8 o'clock in the morning so that we could get in there early, do some shooting before the crowd showed up, a little bit nicer early morning light. And that's not something that's available to the general public, but you can get a pass as a photographer. It runs about $60 for a year that'll enable you to get in at that time. And it's well worth doing. Frankly, what I would say is, even if you're only going to shoot there one day, try to go the day before, buy the pass, so you can get in at 8 a.m. It's actually worth it just for one day's worth of shooting.
That's awesome.
The place is that good. And let me tell you a little bit about what it's like. First of all, not having been there before, I heard Alligator Farm, and I was kind of thinking of those Florida places where they have guys wrestling alligators and, you know, really tacky, really touristy. And it's nothing like that. Instead, what you ought to think of is really high-end, very modern, very humane zoo environment. So all the areas where the animals are, completely natural-looking. It's not one of those ugly old zoos with the cages and stuff like that. It's very nice environment for the animals that are there. And you come in there, and you end up on a series of boardwalks that wind their way into the area where there's a rookery. And that's what it is. You're walking right into a bird rookery. And I got to tell you, Steve and I were just completely blown away when we stepped into this place. There were hundreds of nesting birds all around us, primarily great egrets, although there were a mix of other birds in there too. Primarily larger ones, but a few smaller ones too. And an enormous number of alligators, including some huge ones. But beautiful environment. You're not going to believe it when you step in there. It's absolutely incredible. So we had all these nesting birds just a short distance away from us. And from what Amanda Whitaker, who's the bird and mammal specialist there, told us, and very nice lady, by the way, and very knowledgeable, we weren't even there at the peak time of the year. I mean, we would have thought we were based on the number of birds, but apparently in May, there are many times more birds there, and they can be at distances as close as, you know, just a matter of a few feet away from you.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. So we spent the next couple hours just in photographer heaven, quite honestly, and I think that's a term that we used right at that point, because we just felt like there were great subjects all around us, you know, incredibly rich environment, just wonderful. If you've ever been out there in nature and just have been in that situation where you're just saturated with wonderful subjects, that's what it was like, and really something else. So we came away with a bunch of great photos.
Blew through a few memory cards then, eh?
We took a few shots, I'd have to say, primarily of great egrets as well as some wood storks, a variety of really nice bird life. So I would absolutely recommend it. If you're a photographer and you're living in the northern part of Florida and you haven't been there, I just almost can't believe it. Now, what I used primarily for shooting there was a 200 to 400 Nikkor zoom. It was wonderful for that. I put on a 1.4 teleconverter at times. But frankly, you can get some really nice shots just with something like a 70 to 200. With a teleconverter, you know, like a 1.4, or just even a 70 to 300 zoom, you know, a relatively inexpensive one. So this is not a place that you are required to have some super exotic, really expensive lens to get good pictures.
It easy to get around with your tripod?
Oh, it was a piece of cake, because it's all a boardwalk area, flat, plenty of space. And as I mentioned, we were there before everyone showed up. For the first hour, it was just Steve and me.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was really nice. And the light was good. It was diffused at times. Sometimes the clouds would move back from the sun. It was a little bit brighter, so we'd hold off for a few minutes. If you're going to be around on an overcast day, that'd be perfect.
Wow, that's really great.
Yeah, so
now they have a website, right?
Yep.
We can go to look them up if you're interested in getting some more information. Mm-hmm. It's www.alligatorfarm.com. alligatorfarm.us, mm-hmm. and takes you to their website. It's got information about the rates. I think it's normally about $17 or $18 to get mm-hmm. in. That's for the 9 a.m. entry.
Right, and that gets you into a lot of other exhibits, too, that aren't opened initially. You know, with the early attendance, it's just in the rookery area. But it's a heck of a nice place. And it's, I'll tell you, it's one of those places where after you go there, you're going to want to support them. It's such a quality place.
Cool. And you're not even a bird photographer.
No, but I loved it. I loved it. I had a great time.
We'll make a wildlife guy out of you. Yeah, yeah, Rick.
Now, the second place that we went to, and we actually spent a couple days there, was the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge. And you've been there a bunch, right?
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah. Well, the Merritt Island Refuge is part of Cape Canaveral. The Canaveral National Seashore is on the coast. You drive across the bridge from Titusville, kind of like you're on your way to the Kennedy Space Center, actually. I love this reserve because it's free to get in because it's a national wildlife refuge. It's got a very nice drive, a loop drive. It's, I don't remember how long it is, but it's several miles long.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of estuary areas. And if you go in the morning, you can get some wonderful shots of birds reflected in the water, in the glass-like water. I've got some great shots in my Nikonian's gallery, actually, from there. You'll want a big lens.
Yeah.
At this point, this is where you're going to definitely want to have at least a 400 millimeter and maybe even longer than that if you can get away with it.
Yeah, and we're talking on a digital body.
Yeah.
So on a film body, you know, a 600 wouldn't be a bad thing, although you could probably get by with a 500.
I used my 500 there with my F5, and it mm-hmm. was fine, but there are times when you do want to get a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. It just sort of depends. And what you do is you got to drive around really slow and forget for a minute that you're on a paved road, and just go really, really slow because you never know what you're going to see. For example, I was there a few years ago with my father, and we looked out the side of the car. We were going about 5 miles an hour. People were passing us, and we saw an American bittern, which is...
Those are not common.
Not common at all. Yeah. And I got a picture of one. Not the greatest picture, but I could say I saw it right out of the car window. And so another neat thing to have at Merritt Island is a beanbag. Mm-hmm. And that you can then shoot your lens out of the windowsill of the car. You use a car as a blind.
Yeah.
But you can easily get out and walk around. There's places where you can pull over and you can walk around. There's so much empty space there. I love it because you're not elbow to elbow with a lot of other photographers or anyone else.
No, there were a few out there, but not that many. And we never felt like we were all crowded in. Like you can experience it some places.
Yeah, I've been to other places where it's elbow to elbow with white lenses.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Not there, not at Merritt Island. It's just, it doesn't have the name of some of the other refuges in Florida, but it's really nice.
Yeah, and I've been to a lot of those others, and it's up there in terms of shooting opportunities. It truly is.
Now, the species you're going to see there are going to be things like little blue herons. Mm-hmm. You're going to see, if you're lucky, roseate spoonbills.
Yeah, we saw quite a few and on all the days that we mm-hmm. were there.
Let's see, what else have I gotten good shots of there? Anhingas, no problem.
Right.
Little green heron or green heron. Mm-hmm. They're there, sometimes a little bit more skittish. Like I said, I've seen an American bittern there. Yeah. Turkey vultures, yeah, osprey.
And we saw a fair number of snowy egrets.
That's right.
Yeah, we saw some great egrets. We saw a bald eagle.
Very cool.
Yep, very
They're
cool.
There.
Didn't get any good shots of the bald eagle. But
white ibis.
Yep, white ibis.
And if you
sure.
get really lucky, like I was one time about 3 years ago, glossy ibis, which are much less common.
I don't think we saw those, but I'll have to look in the book and see what
it
looks like.
They're brown with a sort of iridescent color. And
I don't think so.
I'll have to show you my picture someday. But
Certainly saw some alligators.
Yes, and there's alligators there. And it's just a really nice, fun... You want to go in the morning, though. You mm-hmm. definitely want to get the morning light. But it can work in the afternoon as well.
Yeah. Now, again, you know, talking about some equipment stuff with it, because everyone always likes to talk about equipment. I was using the 200, 400 again, and the way the trip turned out, I could have just probably taken that one lens, and that would have been fine, aside from some shots I took at PMA. So I was using that. I was using it with a 1.4 teleconverter quite a bit. I mean, that is one sharp combo. I had it on a pretty beefy tripod. It was my Gitzo 1548, which is their big monster one. But it's not too heavy, so it's pretty easy to carry around. It fits in a suitcase easily.
But a 1325 or equivalent would have been okay?
It would have been fine. Yeah. Or, you know, if you're using an aluminum tripod, something like a 320 or one of the nicer Bogan Manfrotto ones. And then I had one of the Wimberly Sidekicks
mm-hmm.
set up. And if you're not familiar with that, the way that works is that if you have a ball head, it just slips right in the clamp on the ball head. And then it gives you this really nice pivoting mount that makes it just painless to move your big lens around, because it's just all nicely balanced and stuff. And the Sidekick is great.
Now, packable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's tiny, although very effective and very stable. Now, one thing I found is that this was my first time really using the 200 to 400 a lot. I just played with a little bit shooting, you know, photos of license plates across the street and things like that. And the lens worked great. The VR feature is wonderful using that Sidekick, because you don't have to lock anything down, and you'll get sharp photos even at slower shutter speed. So I was able to keep the ISO levels down. I was able to shoot at 100 and 200 and get really nice, clean results and get sharp images.
And
too.
I've seen some of your images that you emailed me, and I was quite frankly just astonished how great they were. They just looked so good. The colors had pop. The bokeh was unbelievably smooth.
Yeah.
The backgrounds were creamy, dreamy. You know, like a Cool Whip commercial or something.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, it was great. They were nice shots and very sharp.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun, like we were talking about. It was a great experience. I think you mentioned some important things. You know, if you're there, drive slowly. Don't rush. Take your time, because you can see an amazing variety of birds there, but it won't happen if you're zooming around at, you know, even 30 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah, even 20 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. You need to just creep along. And
what Steve and I did is we tried to get there early in the morning, you know, right after sunrise, and then we were sure to be back there, you know, toward the end of the day so that we got the better light. And we just did laps, you know, at a very mm-hmm. slow speed, just did laps along the Black Point Wildlife Drive, and that worked great. And had all of our stuff set up, sitting on the back seat, ready to go. And not a problem. We actually didn't use bean bags on this. We just got our tripods out. Mm-hmm. That worked pretty well. There are a few instances where the bean bags would have been good using the car as a
Yeah,
line,
it's just kind of like nice if you can pack it.
Mm-hmm.
If you get yourself a good bean bag with a zipper, you can just pack the bag and then put beans or rice or
yeah.
whatever into it.
And that's what
location.
I planned to do, but I just never got a chance to get the beans while we were down there. But that does have advantages, because some of the birds are a little bit more skittish than others. And in some cases, you're not going to get a good shot if you step out the door of your car.
And then
they
just
get spooked.
You know, the best part of your trip was, and the part that makes me jealous and why I always like to go to, why Merritt Island is one of my favorite places mm-hmm. to visit, because when you're done for lunch, you go to the Dixie Crossroads restaurant.
Ooh.
Which,
ooh.
You know, I'm not looking for free promotion here, but man, they have the best rock shrimp anywhere, hands
yeah,
down.
Yeah, and I can vouch for that now. It is awesome.
You will waddle out of there completely stuffed, but oh my god, it's the best. And the other thing I like about the Dixie Crossroads restaurant too is it's very nature conservation oriented theme. I mean, they got a lot of photographs from local artists and stuff around in there too, and paintings
yeah,
and things.
But they've got rock
shrimp. But their rock shrimp kicks serious booty.
Yeah.
I don't know, is the FCC listening to our podcast?
I think we're okay. with that. So at any rate, great trip, and two places that we absolutely would recommend that you try to hit.
And we hope to be recommending some more places in the very near future.
Yep.
Moving on in the podcast for our last topic of the day, we're going to talk about a software product that we had recently, Rick and I both had the opportunity to evaluate. It's called Exposure from Alien Skin Software. And this is a Photoshop plugin, so you need to have Photoshop, I think CS or CS2
mm-hmm.
will run it. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, we were both using CS2, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if it functions in Photoshop Elements. I think you need the real Photoshop, but I could be wrong. For specifics like that, before I forget, just go to www.alienskin.com and check out their stuff about Exposure. But what Exposure is a film emulator module for Photoshop, for both black and white and color emulsions. And they bill it as the greatest thing, the closest thing to film since film.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that in a lot of respects, they're actually pretty that's pretty fair assessment of what this particular program, this plugin does. It's got a color and a black and white module. And
they have all your favorites in there.
It does. It has everything in there.
Yeah, if you're a black and white shooter, it's got T-Max 100, 400.
Good old Tri-X.
And some of the higher ISO ones that are kind of nasty.
Push process stuff.
Yeah, all sorts of versions of it. And one of the things is, I mean...
Of course, you can set up your own. You can customize this. I mean, it comes with a huge bank of presets.
A lot of presets already.
But then you can save your own presets. Mm-hmm.
The thing that's remarkable to me is when you try them on your screen, it's like, well, yeah, that's Tri-X.
Yeah.
Or that's
I had a Darkroom flashback.
Oh, it's pretty cool.
It was wicked cool.
Yeah, they've done some neat things with the grain, too, because if you've tried putting grain into your images with Photoshop, it doesn't look that great. You know, it sort of looks like it, but this stuff looks like the real thing.
And this is probably... before we go on to any of the other things that it does, I mean, the exposure plugin, it does a lot of things that you could do in Photoshop anyway.
Yeah, it's a whole lot more simple.
But it's a little bit easier. It's all in one spot, and you can do it and then save this sort of preset and apply that as in one shot rather than having to do a bunch of different things. But if there's one strength to exposure, it has got to be grain and black and white.
Yeah,
I would say from the kind of photography the kind of applications that I do, for me, black and white conversions are always a real pain. And then I've used the grain filter in Photoshop and been absolutely, no offense Adobe, but I've been absolutely disgusted by what it produces.
Right.
And the reason is that the grain in Adobe Photoshop is limited to a size of 1 pixel. So it's very uniform. It just looks like dots. In my opinion.
Yeah, and this stuff looks like grain. You see clumping and just all the kinds of things that you would see with real film.
Now, there's
something really funny about this, actually.
Right, because we always talk about noise reduction, right?
Well, you know, it's the idea that when we were all shooting film, which wasn't very long ago, that what we cared most about was reducing grain and eliminating grain. And then when we got digital cameras, we thought that was cool because especially at the lower ISO settings, they're just darn clean. And you don't see grain. And now we're figuring out ways of putting grain back into pictures.
Right. Now, there's a big reason why you would put grain back into your picture, though, especially on black and whites. And that's apparent sharpness.
Right.
And apparent sharpness is not sharpness. It's a psychological effect. When there's grain in your image, it will look sharper to a human.
Yeah. And the same is true with color, too, at larger sizes.
Yes, and larger sizes is where you'll start to see that. Mm-hmm. So I think for folks who are making very large prints, you know, above... 13x19, you may actually benefit a little bit by adding some film grain effect into your image to make it look a little sharper on the final print.
Yeah. So alien skin exposure is one way to do that. Now, we talked a little bit about the black and white options. Let's talk a little bit about color. There was a wide range of options there, too.
Including some really crazy old favorites, you know, Agfa chrome stuff from God knows
when. Some stuff that I would never use, too.
Stuff I never even put in my
camera. Nasty 1970, mid-70s vintage Kodachrome stuff.
Or Ektachrome, even.
I mean, Ektachrome, not Kodachrome.
You know how Ektachrome slides looked bluish? They got it.
Oh,
if you want that look, you can click that preset and you
blech.
You can get... But it's sort of a testimony to alien skin because they got it right. I mean, it looks correct.
I think that kind of thing. There are definitely some settings in there that are probably more of interest to graphics artists.
Absolutely.
Than photographers. There are several in there like that. They're fun. It's remarkable because, like you were saying, you click that and it's like, oh, yeah, now I remember why I hated that.
Yeah, the Kodachrome 200 setting. Damn, it looked just like it.
Yeah, greeny, kind of muted. Yeah. But, you know, that one's an interesting effect. There's some situations where that could be pretty nice. There are also cross-processing things. That's kind of a cool look at times. Not something I would probably do a lot, but some people that like those kind of out-there images will have a lot of fun with the cross-processing settings. It's got... ones for Velvia 100, you know, both current varieties of it.
The 100 and the 100F.
Yeah, the way it starts off at its normal setting, it's a bit overcooked. But it's got an opacity setting, just like you have with layers in Photoshop. In fact, that's one of the options, is setting it up as a layer, and then you can adjust the opacity later. Both of us, I think, had the same reaction. You want to dial that down to, instead of a 100%, down around 50, 60 maybe at the most.
Yeah.
That's plenty of saturation. At 100, it's just over the top. But that's okay. It's giving you a wide range of things that you can do, but plan on dialing that one down.
Now, in both of the black and white and tasteful. The color, you can adjust the tone curves, the contrast. Mm-hmm.
You can even do sharpening.
You can do sharpening, and you can sharpen in the luminosity channel. So it's kind of nice there. So there's just a lot of things you can do. It's just one. It's kind of like one-stop shopping when you're applying these things on a plug-in.
Yeah. Very powerful tool. Now, one other thing that's kind of handy is going back to the black and white conversions. If you've done that in Photoshop, most people find that the best way to do it is using the channel mixer tool. Now, the only thing that's a pain in the neck is you've got little sliders for each of the colors, and you want to have them set so that the numbers on each one of them add up to 100. So with Photoshop, you've kind of got to do that calculation in your head. It's not super hard.
You just need a slide rule in a few minutes, and it's fine.
Yeah. Slide rule helps. With the Alien Skin Exposure one, it automatically does that balancing for you. So it's just a little bit easier. You adjust red and the other channels automatically.
Yes, it compensates. Always sums to 100. It's nice.
So for black and white conversions, I would absolutely use this from this point forward.
The other thing you can do with the black and white is you can make some pretty interesting duotones or tritones. You can add multiple colors. You can adjust how much is in the highlight or the shadow or both. And that was kind of fun. I don't do that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this from a pure photography standpoint. Yeah. But it was nice. It was easy to do, and it does allow some creativity.
Yeah. It also has, in the black and white plug-in module, an infrared film emulation, and that wasn't a bad emulation. It looks pretty close, you know, to typical black and white infrared.
Somewhere
stuff.
Out there, Bjorn is smacking us around the.
Oh, there isn't an ultraviolet one, but
no, but yeah, that's true. There's no UV, but
yeah, I would have liked to have seen some color infrared filters. That would have been kind of cool, but that's about the only thing that's missing out of this that I could see. It's got a large number of things. So, would I recommend it? Yeah, I think if you're wanting to emulate some of those older films and are looking for some more of those out there kind of things, and if you just want that grain emulation, it's the best thing out there in the market that I know of. I haven't seen anything else that's got its depth and variety. So check it out. Go to alienskin.com.
I would say for doing black and white conversions, it's going to be my tool of choice,
because
I can really punch them up and make them look good. That's the good news. The bad news is that it's $199, so not a cheap plug-in.
Yeah,
but I think given it's in the price range for Photoshop plugins, it's a little high. But given everything that it does, you know, it's got a lot of effects and a lot of tools, so I can understand why it would maybe cost that much.
Of course, what I like about Alien Skin the best is they've got one product called Image Doctor.
That's right, which we have yet to review.
Yeah, that seems like a natural. So I think that's it for that. Cool product.
Yes, very cool.
Yep. All right, let's talk a little bit about next time.
Next time.
What's our date for the next podcast?
We're looking at something like the, 2 weeks from
30th?
From now. I think that would be the 30th. Let me pull up my calendar, Rick, and it says Image Doctors right there on March 30th.
Yep.
That's when we will be heard from again. We hope. And we're going to talk about raw converters, aren't we?
Yep.
There's a lot of raw converters out there, and we've had a chance to sample some of them, not all of them, but
pretty good number. I've been playing with about 5 or 6 over the last couple weeks and just trying images in each one of those, you know, a variety of things. So we'll talk about that, talk, you know, briefly about workflow and some ideas there too. That's been a request that we've received recently.
Yeah, and in another request that was sort of gone answered is that if you go into the Nikonians forums under the community there, we now have a podcast discussion forum.
Yep.
And that would be a great place to bombard us with your comments, questions, hate
mail.
Make
them nice. Yeah. Our mothers may read them. So.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to post it in the forums, you know, they are moderated, so we got to be nice. But you don't have to kiss up to us.
No.
And
if you want to talk about some of the topics that we've discussed today and take them further, if you have questions on alien skin exposure or the Merritt Island wildlife refuge, let's do it.
We'll post some links in there for you about this podcast in the next day or so. We'll post some links and so that you can go to, say, the Merritt Island homepage and some of these other places.
Right.
And as usual, don't forget, if you have a question you'd like to ask us directly and not in the forums, you can always send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org.
Yep, we're pretty good about responding to those.
We try.
Yep.
So until next time, it's been great having you here listening to us. From me and from Rick.
Sayonara.
Sayonara. Hasta la vista, baby.
My servants break the land. Oxygen and aeronaut. Clandestine and faith. 2,000 years of misery. Of torture in my name.